I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Rick Santorum won 11 state caucuses and primaries and received the support of more than 3 million voters in his quest for the Republican presidential nomination, but that wasn't enough to beat frontrunner Mitt Romney. Yesterday in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, Santorum announced that he was suspending his campaign. NPR's national political correspondent Don Gagne was there, and he joins us on Radio Times. And Don Gagne, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
You're very welcome. So what does it mean to suspend a campaign, his campaign? Because Santorum also said yesterday the game is a long way from over.
Yeah, you heard a lot of different things in the space of about 2 minutes there. I mean, at one point he said this campaign is over, and then he said the game is not over. Now, that means he's someone who's going to continue to fight for what he believes in and working to defeat Barack Obama. It presumably means he's going to help Mitt Romney, but he didn't say any of that specifically yesterday. But in terms of the question of suspending a campaign, that's one of those legal campaign terms.
And does that mean you can pay off some of your debts?
It means you can continue to raise money to pay off debt. I guess it would also mean that if something should happen, who knows what it would be, you could kind of gear it back up without having to file new paperwork and all that kind of stuff. But it basically means the campaign is over, that they've thrown in the towel. But by suspending it, it allows the campaign to still function in ways that it needs to raise money, pay off debts, do all that sort of thing.
And what were Santorum's reasons?
You know, this is interesting, too. Yesterday was really about kind of basking in the glow of all that this underdog campaign accomplished. And certainly you look at the arc of this campaign, and it is pretty remarkable. And I think it was the most unexpected story, you know, and perhaps the big story of this campaign so far. But in terms of reasons, we could infer what the reasons were. But he didn't do any interviews yesterday, except for the one that he did with Dr. James Dobson in Lancaster last night. Certainly, you know, I think it's reasonable to take him at his word that family considerations and this latest setback in health care with his you know daughter Bella certainly did give him a chance to pause and kind of look at where they were at. She went into the hospital once earlier in the campaign. At that point, he was still kind of a rising candidate. At this point, when he's looking at the poll numbers nationally, the poll numbers in Pennsylvania, where he risked losing, perhaps being embarrassed in his home state, you do the math, which he always resisted doing, on the delegates, and you put all of that together, and it's pretty obvious that all of that is what finally caused him to say, you know, let's pull the plug right now.
And interestingly, looking at some of the polling in Pennsylvania not so long ago, a month or so ago, he was beating Mitt Romney by, you know, double digits, and then a pretty precipitous fall for him.
Exactly. And here's the other thing. Let's say the polls hadn't tanked in Pennsylvania. Everybody wins their home state. Newt Gingrich won his home state, you know, and didn't get much juice from that. When Romney won Michigan, we can call, you know, almost call New Hampshire and some of these other places home states for him too. But Michigan obviously is his native home state. That was important, but also discounted a little bit, and he barely won it. So Santorum, say he won Pennsylvania, but loses the others, the other four, I think, that are being held on the same day. Then what is there to brag about, really? So he was in a pretty bad position there.
And, of course, a reminder of how badly he lost to now Senator Bob Casey Jr.
Exactly. Perhaps redeeming that loss would have been a reason to stay in if it looked like a win in Pennsylvania was a sure thing. But as soon as it ceased to be a sure thing, and it had indeed ceased to be a sure thing, you know, the risk of a loss to Mitt Romney in a Republican primary after losing a general so badly to Bob Casey really is a 1-2 punch. And that's that's a really tough thing to spin, either the morning after or a couple of years later if you want to do something else down the road.
Well, Don, you called him, you know, a real underdog candidate, and I'm thinking of those debates early on. I guess this takes us back to late summer, early fall, when he was on the edge of the debate, you know, and oftentimes forgotten by the moderator. And lo and behold, as he made inroads, he got to center stage.
As you're covering those debates, you look at this stage full of, you know, 8 or 9 or 10 characters, and each of them has their own narrative and their own story. But you're thinking, okay, Morning Edition is giving me 7 or 8 or 9 minutes,
yes,
but it's going to be something to get them all in. And he was one of the forgotten guys. I guess I'd have to go back and look at the pieces I did based on those early debates to see how many of them included a clip of tape from Rick Santorum. He was just he was a hat in the ring, but not one that anybody truly took seriously. And it's because he'd been out of public life for so long, and because of the way he exited public life with that stinging defeat to Senator Casey. There was just no real path for him, except lo and behold, yeah, he found one.
Well, and not to overdo these dog metaphors, but he was dogged.
I've pulled this piece of tape out a few times over the course of the past couple of months. But back in August, we were in Waterloo, Iowa, and it was the Black Hawk County Republican dinner. I think it was Black Hawk County. And, Senator Santorum was going to be there, but also there were Michelle Bachmann, who had just won the Ames straw poll and was the new darling of the Tea Party and the real conservative wing of the Republican Party, and a guy named Texas Governor Rick Perry, who was just in the race but was already the front runner. And so it was going to be the three of them speaking at this dinner back to back to back. And there was a big entourage when Perry came in, and all the reporters swarming him, and all the people in the crowd looking for autographs and pictures, and they're playing the Yellow Rose of Texas. Bachmann also makes a big entrance. And I'm standing up front thinking, well, you know, I want to see what kind of entrance Mr. Santorum makes. And, you know, a single pickup truck pulls up, and he and his daughter get out. Mm-hmm. And I walk up to him, and I kind of made some reference to the lack of the entourage. And I said, what do you make of this? And he said, I'm the little engine that could. He said, all these other shiny cars and engines keep going past, but I'm the little engine that could. And sure enough, he was. Now, he didn't make it all the way over the top of the hill, but he did predict at least some of what would follow.
Do you think, though, his focus on some of these social issues and statements like Kennedy's speech about religion making him want to throw up, colleges and indoctrination mills, even Obama being a snob because he supports people going to getting higher education, even birth control as sinful, that it had a certain appeal to a certain segment of the Republican party, but that it hurt him in the long run?
Oh, absolutely. In the early, you know, in a place like Iowa, it helped him. You know, in some of the southern states that he won, in some of the small caucus battles, it helped him, because those are the kinds of primaries contests where the barriers to participation are more complicated. You know, I mean, you can't just go take 2 minutes and vote anytime between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. You have to go to a meeting and listen to this and really spend some time with it. So in places where you kind of got the most active, most dedicated participants in the process, he would do well, as long as those were also places where the majority of the people self-identified as being very strong Christian conservatives or evangelicals. If you look at the states, and these tended to be the bigger states, and they tended to be the places like Michigan and Wisconsin and Illinois, if you looked at places where fewer people identified themselves that way, and where they were primaries where it was much easier to vote, he did not do so well. So it was those views were, you know, things that they helped him in some places, hurt him in others. But I really go back to two places. I go back to Michigan and Ohio. He was so close to Mitt Romney in both of those places. And Michigan was absolutely a must-win for Romney. Ohio was something Romney really, you know, wanted and maybe needed, but it wasn't quite as critical. But as soon as Romney won both of those, then you just couldn't see the path for Santorum anymore. And that was right in there when he was calling President Obama a snob for you know, the college remark and the JFK thing and some of the other things. So that was an example of the undisciplined nature of his campaign. That's the way he liked it. That's the way it was. And then it was all complicated by the fact that he just didn't have the organization. Mm-hmm. So even if he had won Ohio, Mitt Romney probably would have gotten more delegates because he wasn't eligible for delegates all across the state because that boring stuff like paperwork hadn't been filed and signatures hadn't been filed in this district or that county.
And only a couple more minutes before we have to say goodbye. But would you say, Don, that Rick Santorum forced Mitt Romney to the right?
Oh, he absolutely did. He absolutely did. And, I mean, I do think we'll see a different tone from Mitt Romney now. I mean, we've already in recent weeks seen him kind of shifting the focus to President Obama even more intensely. But he definitely, on everything from Romney Care and Obamacare to social issues, he forced Romney to the right, and that's the kind of thing that prompted the whole Etch-a-Sketch, kerfuffle. So Santorum getting out now means Romney can start, kind of recalibrating and refocusing, and it'll be interesting to see if he's able to, turn some of those general public approval numbers that have been slipping around once he doesn't have to contend with somebody like Rick Santorum on his right.
But are Newt Gingrich and Ron Paul, are they essentially, quote-unquote, out of the race even though they're still running?
Yeah, and they have been for a while. I mean, Ron Paul, he's not won a single state. And it's a matter of time for them. I mean, they're making the calculation based on other things. Neither of them sees a path to victory. So if they're in it, they're in it for other reasons at this point. But Santorum was the last kind of real potential challenger.
And we're almost out of time here, but he's a relatively young man when it comes to people with presidential aspirations.
Absolutely. Born in, 1958?
Something like that?
There is time, and I think that's also part of the consideration for not kind of riding it until the wheels completely fall off. He got to get out on his own terms, and that's important as you ponder potential future races.
Well, Don Gagne, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
This was fun. Anytime. Thanks.
You're very welcome. And he's NPR's national political correspondent joining us to talk about yesterday's news that Rick Santorum is suspending his campaign for the GOP presidential nomination. We have two guests waiting in the wings. We'll be talking about taxes and the economy and job creation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Philadelphia Theater Company supports WHYY and welcomes The Outgoing Tide, the newest play from acclaimed Philadelphia playwright Bruce Graham, writer of Something Intangible and Any Given Monday. In a summer cottage on the Chesapeake, Gunner hatches an unorthodox plan to secure his family's future, but meets with opposition from his wife and grown son. The Outgoing Tide hums with dark humor and profound emotion. Tickets at 215-985-0420 or philadelphiatheatercompany.org.
This week in This American Life, Jack's father had been mad, but never like this.
And he said, "I've worked all my life to make sure that when you walk down the street, people say, 'There goes a hit. They're good people.' I don't think anybody has damaged that reputation as much as you have today."
Honor thy father and mother. It's the Ten Commandments this week on This American Life.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
The Chester County Hospital supports WHYY and is committed to delivering comprehensive care in an environment where respect, compassion, and quality come first. To learn how they help make lives better every day, chestercountyhospital.org. Supporting WHYY, Cohen Media Group, presenting The Lady, the true story of Nobel Peace Prize laureate Aung San Suu Kyi of Myanmar and her journey from house arrest to parliament, in theaters Friday.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. President Obama went to Florida yesterday to raise money for his reelection campaign and to promote a 30% minimum tax rate for millionaires and the very wealthy. Using Warren Buffett's tax return as Exhibit A, Mr. Obama said it wasn't fair that a billionaire should pay a lesser federal tax rate than his or her secretary. Mitt Romney opposes raising taxes on the wealthy. In fact, he believes their taxes should be cut. President Obama is reiterating his message today. And with Rick Santorum out of the race, it looks like the general election has begun and taxes, jobs, government spending, and the economy will be the centerpiece of the race. We invited two economists to join us on Radio Times. Let me introduce them to you. Anthony Davis is Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University and a senior scholar at Mercatus Center, and that's at George Mason University. And Anthony Davis, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Also with us is John T. Harvey, Professor of Economics at Texas Christian University. His blog is Pragmatic Economics, and you can see it at Forbes.com. And John T. Harvey, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you very much.
John, if I could begin with you, do you think for President Obama this is a winning political issue to talk about Warren Buffett's tax returns?
Uh-oh, you've started off with a politics question.
I'm sorry.
Question.
I know. I wasn't sure where to begin, but that's...
You know, it could very possibly play to people's sort of populist sentiments. You know, if you want to get around to, do I think it's a good idea, I think it's probably window dressing. You know, the deficit, what, in 2011 was $1.3 trillion, and I've seen estimates of how much money this would generate between $37 and $50 billion. That's like if we owed, you know, if the deficit was $1.30, this is less than a penny. So, you know, as far as deficit reduction, it really doesn't do anything.
What's your take on it, Anthony Davis?
Yeah, I agree. I've seen the same figures, about $50 billion in savings, but the footnote is that's $50 billion over the course of 10 years. So you're talking $5 billion a year. That's roughly enough to fund the government for 6 hours.
Which, of course, is not very much. But I think the president is talking about, either rightly or wrongly, and I'll go back to you, John, about tax fairness and the idea that we have a tax system that allows wealthy people to pay a lot less than 30% when it comes to their federal income tax.
Well, gosh, I apologize for screwing up all your questions.
No, go ahead.
Because I, you know, the reason I call my blog at Forbes Pragmatic Economics is because I try to stay away from, as much as possible, from sort of subjective judgments. You know, whether it's fair or not, I don't care. That's not true, but I don't care as an economist. But, you know, do I think that a distribution of income that is more towards the wealthy tends to lower overall demand? Yeah, I do. Do I think that it's, you know, that the current tax structure is unfair? I kind of avoid answering that question. So, although I'll say this, too, in terms of shifting the distribution of income more evenly, I don't think it probably makes about as much difference to that as it does to reducing the deficit.
Well, let me just quote something, and this comes from the White House, so you can take it with however big a grain of salt you want, that nearly a quarter of all millionaires, and that's about 55,000 taxpayers, pay a lower tax rate than nearly 1.5 million Americans whose income of $100,000 to $250,000 puts them in what is considered the upper middle class, and I'm quoting there from the New York Times. Anthony Davis, people complain about fairness or the lack of fairness in our tax system, and I guess what the president is trying to do is to say that wealthy Americans at least has to pay the same tax rate as upper middle class Americans.
Yes. And what's going on here is it's a bit disingenuous. There's a bait and switch. What they're quoting are the marginal tax rates. The marginal tax rate simply measures how much tax you're going to pay on the next dollar of income that you earn. When you're talking about how much tax people have paid, the marginal rate's irrelevant. What you need to look at is the average rate. The average tax rate for the top 1% in this country, federal taxes all combined, is about 30%. The average tax rate for the middle class is about 14%, or about half of what the top 1% are paying.
And you're, when you talk about that, you're talking about Social Security, all the taxes
that
people
all
pay.
In. Social Security, excise, income tax, the whole business. It's the difference between, imagine you're going down the road, and I want to know how far have you traveled. You don't look at the speedometer. The speedometer only tells you how fast you're going right now. That's what a marginal tax rate does. It tells you how much you're paying right now, not how much have you paid up to this point.
John, you want to weigh in on that?
And I have no problem with that. I guess, you know, once again, screwing up your question, my focus will be elsewhere. You know, this, you know, emphasis on, you know, sort of changing the tax rates, even if it were unfair, I would much rather see Obama focusing on job creation. And that's not what I see.
Well, let me ask you then a question that you feel more comfortable asking, which is, but keying off of what we were just talking about, are millionaires and billionaires, John T. Harvey, are they job creators?
I don't think so. The middle class are the job creators. That, you know, firms are looking for, you know, expected sales, and the vast majority of your sales are going to come from the middle class. There's this, you know, fiction, which is not entirely false, but it's overplayed, that the wealthy are somehow the ones, you know, running all the investments and so forth. And what you're doing there is you're being a little bit, you know, not very careful with the distinction between financial investment and physical investment. Physical being, you know, building factories and restaurants and so forth, and financial being buying stocks and bonds. And there's a connection, but it's very tenuous. And you know, sometimes it's a very bad connection in that we'd rather not have it that way. But no, I would say that the people who are creating jobs are the middle class and the poor.
And by creating jobs, you mean literally creating companies or opening stores and hiring people?
No, I mean creating the demand that then leads firms to decide to do those things, to decide to hire workers and decide to open stores and so forth. That in fact, what the firms are doing in establishing, you know, new employing new workers and establishing subsidiaries and so forth, is reacting to what the consumers are doing in you know, buying goods and services. So, you know, if you want, let's say you have a restaurant that's half full, you know, what's, you know, who's really creating the jobs there, the customers or the proprietor?
So
I'm leaning towards the customers.
I hear you. So, well, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying, John, is that we have a demand problem in this country.
That would be correct, yeah.
Do you agree with that, Anthony?
Well, I think we're missing a key player here. We talk about taxing the rich versus taxing the middle class, and we're missing, what we're missing is the people who are the millionaire wannabes. That's where the true job creation occurs. I mean, you imagine, look at Mark Zuckerberg, founder of Facebook. We could tax him 100% of his income right now, and it's not going to have any effect on the jobs that he created because they've already been created. What we want to be careful about is by imposing high taxes on millionaires, we discourage the young entrepreneurs from taking risks and starting companies that do create jobs in the future.
What do you think the chance of someone becoming a millionaire like Zuckerberg, Anthony?
Well, you could look at the news and, the name escapes me, but the website that he just bought for $1 billion that put sepia tone photographs on the web, 12 months ago, those two young founders, college kids, were not billionaires. Today they are.
But wouldn't you say, and this is you, Anthony Davies, but wouldn't you say that most job creators in this country have smaller enterprises, and it would be great if they became millionaires or even billionaires, but most of them probably make, you know, between $50,000 and $100,000.
Yes, and the thing we have to be a little bit careful of is while what you say is correct, and they probably do make a couple of $100,000 income, the amount of assets they're sitting on, if I have a building, I have machinery that generates that income for me and the income for my employees, when you look at my assets, I look like a millionaire. And particularly when we start defining millionaire down to someone who earns $250,000, all of a sudden it's those middle-class business owners, the entrepreneurs, that are going to start feeling the heat.
John, let me go back to you. Last month, about 110,000 new jobs added to the economy, I think less than people were hoping for. What does that tell you, I guess, about the health of the U.S. economy?
Well, nothing good.
Yeah.
and I think this is where maybe Dr. Davies and I would split on this. My feeling is we need to have a bigger deficit, that the government needs to expand the economy more to create the income, to create the jobs, that then allow entrepreneurs to undertake projects that become profitable. Entrepreneurs' problem is not their marginal tax rates or regulations or something like this. Is they don't have any customers.
And you're saying, I'll go back to you, Anthony, but you're saying, John, that the government can create customers for private enterprise?
Well, I mean, every time a soldier goes to Walmart, every time a police officer fills their tank with gas, and that's exactly what's happening.
And even though we have a $15 trillion debt, as we can afford to add to that debt?
Well, the debt, as a percentage of GDP, was much bigger during World War II, and thereafter, of course, the 50s were the happy days. And furthermore, it is impossible for the U.S. to be forced to default on its debt because it's all in dollars. I mean, and this is, you know, something that Alan Greenspan talked about before Congress a couple of months ago. And we can choose to default. And I'm not saying there are not other economic consequences.
Right.
But in terms of, you know, can we afford to do so? Absolutely.
And so another stimulus.
Absolutely. And one that doesn't underestimate the size of the problem like the first one did.
Well, let me just quickly reintroduce you and also open up the lines as well. That's John T. Harvey. He's a professor of economics at Texas Christian University. His blog, Pragmatic Economics, is published at Fords.com. Anthony Davies is associate professor of economics at Duquesne University and a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center, and that's at George Mason University. And we are talking about taxes, job creation, the economy, government spending, debt. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Anthony, do you favor more government spending?
No, very much I don't. All due respect to John, I think when we say things like the government creates jobs, we're missing half of the picture. Certainly when the government spends money, jobs appear. But the money the government spends doesn't fall from space. It's got to either borrow or tax to raise that money. And when it does those things, jobs disappear. So at the end of the day, all the government does is push jobs from one place in the economy to somewhere else.
So you're saying that that government spending or overspending actually hurts job creation?
I would say at best it does nothing for job creation on the net. At worst, it actually is bad for all of us because the jobs that get created are jobs that involve producing things the government wants as opposed to jobs that involve producing things that people want.
Well, what about, you know, rebuilding some of our roads and highways and bridges, Anthony? I mean, we have serious infrastructure needs in this country.
Sure, but the infrastructure needs pale in comparison to the amount of money we're talking about spending. Right now, and I also take issue I take a different position than John and with regard to the debt. The amount of debt we're in right now causes us to pay in interest a tremendous amount of money, so much so that if interest rates on the debt rise just 1%, that will cost us as much as another Iraq-Afghanistan war.
$1 trillion?
No, it'll cost us several hundred billion dollars a year, just a 1% increase.
John, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, people said the same thing in the 80s when the national debt was going up so much under Reagan, and it turned out to be false. And furthermore, Dr. Davies, I think one of the places where I would disagree with your premise is that when the government spends money, it's not a question of, you know, either that job would have been in the private sector or it would have been in the government, so that it ends up being what the government wants. It's that there wouldn't have been a job or the government creates a job.
Yeah, I have to take that on faith. The fact of the matter is if we look at the data going back to the 1950s and compare changes in government spending to economic growth on a per capita basis, what we find is at best no relationship whatsoever. And at worst, if you start looking at things like weighted averages over time, you actually find a negative relationship. That is, as government spending has increased, on average, the economy has contracted.
Well, John, let me
actually,
go ahead. I read
Dr. Davies' paper on that. And I didn't see that you were calculating that on the basis of a full employment budget because, of course, when the economy goes into recession, that causes us to go into deficit.
Yes, that's correct. If you lag one, and we're going to bore your readers, your listeners now. If you lag, you get the effect I think you're looking for.
Well, let me just jump in here. We've got dueling economists, and that's actually what we want to do today on Radio Times. But let me go back to you, John. You're saying the government spending can help the economy. Where should that spending be spent?
It should be direct job creation on projects that otherwise would not have been profitable but are nevertheless socially useful. For example, you know, I mean, the easy example that no one has any disagreement with, you know, things like education or fire protection or police protection or the military in particular. You know, during the Great Depression, we hired people to build dams and so forth that otherwise would not necessarily have been profitable but served a social purpose. And apparently, they did things like pay historians to go around interviewing people who had been ex-slaves. This was the sort of last time when slaves would still be alive before they passed on. You know, was that going to be profitable? Not necessarily, but this was a part of American history that we would have lost.
But at some point, those jobs end, and how do you create an economy that that allows those people to keep working if the government isn't sending them a paycheck?
We won't. And furthermore, what you say is just as true of the private sector. That's what's so often overlooked. that, you know, we only need so many restaurants. Mm-hmm. So you can lay the exact same criticism against the private sector as you do against these government sector jobs.
Anthony, you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, well, I think I take issue with characterizing something as socially useful and then following up and saying that it's not profitable. Profit is generated precisely when you produce something that people like so much that they're willing to give you their money in exchange for it. So it's a contradiction to say that something is so socially useful yet not profitable. So, take education as an example. The average college graduate today in the United States, his degree is worth about $1 million net of tuition. There's no reason why the federal government should be subsidizing that. We can say that, well, an education is a valuable thing, it's socially useful. It is, and the marketplace rewards that social usefulness. And as soon as the marketplace stops rewarding it, it becomes no longer socially useful. Or I should say, not as useful as the resources we could have expended somewhere else.
Well, and I don't agree with that, as you probably are not surprised to hear.
Not surprised at all. No, go ahead, John.
But, for example, child welfare. I mean, there is no profit in going around and investigating, reports of child abuse. And yet I don't know of much that would be more socially useful than that. So if we just depend on the private sector, such agencies would not exist. It's also not profitable to offer police protection to the poor. You know, by definition, anything that the poor, you know, are interested in is not going to necessarily be profitable.
Well, even going back to you, Anthony, and this is not a crack on profit-making companies or private enterprise, but it seems to me their goal is to make money. And if jobs are created, that's a good byproduct. But their goal is to make money either for their owners or their stockholders.
Sure, and the way they make money is by giving people what people want. The neat thing about the private sector versus the government is if you don't like what the company is offering, you don't have to buy it. And what happens is the company now is forced, because it's pursuing profit, it's forced to figure out what you do want and to deliver the thing you want. We don't have that dynamic with government. You're forced at gunpoint to hand over your money, and you're going to eat whatever it is the government wants you to eat.
But picking up on what John was saying about investigating reports of child abuse, do you see that as something the government should do and has a benefit to the society as a whole?
Well, I think both John and I would agree that it has a benefit to society as a whole, and it should be done. The question is it necessary for the government to do it? There are plenty of things that are done that have value and aren't necessarily motivated by profit, that are done by private charities or done by the Catholic Church. There's no reason a priori to assume that just because it's valuable and doesn't generate a profit that the government has to do it.
And we're almost up at a break here. Anthony, do we need a government then?
Whether or not I'm on my meds.
Well, no. I mean, it seems like you're saying the government shouldn't do almost anything.
Well, I think there's a valuable role for government. The government is a tool of coercion. Anytime it's necessary to force people to behave in a manner they would not behave involuntarily, that's a role for government.
And that's Anthony Davies. He's Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University, a senior scholar at their Mercatus Center, and that's at George Mason University. He joins us along with John T. Harvey, Professor of Economics at Texas Christian University. His blog, Pragmatic Economics, is published at Forbes.com. We are talking about a whole host of things, including government spending. Do we need a government? Private enterprise? Taxes? Job creation? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Programming is supported by 21st Century Cyber Charter School, providing public online education for grades 6 through 12, utilizing the latest information and communication technology. More information at 21stcenturycyber.org.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. What happens to the Central Asia Institute now that Montana's Attorney General has ordered Three Cups of Tea author and founder Greg Mortensen off the board? They're going forward, as we'll hear. Also, Anne Lamott on sudden grandmotherhood. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY, Bosch Thermotechnology, manufacturer of geothermal heat pumps that use the constant temperature of the earth to heat and cool homes. More information at boschgeo.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about tax policy, job creation, budget battles, and the economy with John T. Harvey and Anthony Davies. And I do want to get to our callers, but John, I just want to give you a chance to weigh in on what Anthony was saying right before the break, which is the government's job is essentially to make people, to coerce people to do things they don't want to do.
Well, you know, I don't disagree with a lot of what, you know, Dr. Davies says. I come from, and he probably understands this better, from a post-Keynesian perspective, which actually has a lot in common with his perspective, the Austrian perspective. I guess probably the biggest difference is I believe that the private sector, left to its own devices, does not create sufficient demand to hire everyone who's willing to work. And Dr. Davies, correct me if I'm wrong, but from his approach, there's an assumption that the private sector automatically does that. And so if it's not doing it right now, as the case is right now,
right,
then there must be something in the way. To me, the result we're having right now could happen in a pure free market economy with no government whatsoever. And so the government is necessary to solve this problem. Am I happy about that? No, I'm not. But to me, you know, the fact that that I'm uncomfortable with the government giving that much power does not trump the economic truth that this is the way the economy works.
Yeah, quick response, Anthony.
Yeah, I think we agree more with each other than we do with the current policy. I'd be willing to try out John's proposal that the private sector doesn't create enough demand, provided we followed the whole Keynesian prescription, which is, as the economy picks back up, you cut back on the government spending. And we haven't seen that. What we see is politicians using recessions as an excuse to expand government and then never contracting it.
Right.
But I mean, that I hear this of people, you know, criticizing government spending, Anthony, but they rarely ever tell us exactly where they're going to make all those cuts in spending. Do you have a list? A short list?
No, I don't have a list, and I'll tell you why. Because we are spending so much more than we bring in. We could shut down everything, shut down the entire government with the exception of Social Security, Medicare, and interest on the debt, and we still wouldn't balance the budget. So we talk about things like, you know, shutting down the program to Mars or building or not building this particular aircraft carrier. It's complete nonsense.
John, can we afford this debt?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Now, however, I do totally agree with Dr. Davies on his implication that, you know, the way things are running right now, it gives politicians a great deal of power to sort of expand, and never have to worry about cutting back. On the other hand, I think that, you know, a deficit is sustainable forever. And, in fact, it's necessary forever because deficits inject wealth into the private sector. And surpluses, you know, suck wealth out of the private sector. I mean, if you imagine a situation in which the government spent no money but only taxed, then the government would have a big surplus.
Right.
And the private sector would be losing income.
Interesting.
So, you know, now how do we control the government and at the same time say, yeah, you know, go ahead and spend money? That's a political problem that I probably should think about. But
you're not going to... No, that's fair enough. And I do want to get... We have the calls pulsating at me here. We have Charles Charles from West Philadelphia joining us on Radio Times. Hi, Charles. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, I just... They touched on it a little bit, but I want to know, during, you know, the Great Depression, about 12,000 or 12 million jobs were created, and also two of the biggest expenditures we have now, Social Security and federal job insurance, are basically were instituted, you know, when there essentially was no money. So why isn't more effort being made in Congress to talk about ways of doing that? Your guests talked about it a little bit, but I wonder if they could try to compare the situations and try to answer why it is or is not feasible now.
Okay, fair enough. Anthony Davies, he's wondering whether the government can do what the government did under FDR in the Depression.
Well, I'm not sure that we remember what the government did under FDR correctly. The fact is, following the initial decline in 29, the economy showed signs of picking up prior to the institution of the big government spending in the New Deal. And once this came online, what we saw was the economy turn back down again. So there's some evidence that bring us out of the Great Depression. In fact, what happened is the government spending prolonged it.
Do you agree with that, John?
Again, not surprisingly, no. that in fact, that was my latest blog entry, was looking at deficit spending under FDR, and under Hoover as well, and then through World War II, and the reaction of unemployment. And actually, the time when the unemployment jumped back up again from 37 to 38 was when they decided to do, and this will sound familiar, hey, let's balance the budget. It looks like the economy is doing well. So they cut way back on spending, and all of a sudden unemployment jumped back up again.
Well, and I wonder if we even have a modern model for that, Anthony, which is you look at Europe where, you know, they're cutting government spending, and we see really high rates of unemployment. Now, maybe a bit apples and oranges because they have a different economic system, but nonetheless, should we be concerned about that?
Well, we saw tremendously high unemployment there prior to the to cutting the government spending. I think one of the differences between United States during FDR's time and today is that the size of government was much smaller. We had the government had much more elbow room to move about than it does today.
Let me get Jack from Center City, Philadelphia, to join us. And Jack, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, Professor Davies. I wonder how you feel about the tax benefits given to the oil industry, ostensibly during the 90s when oil was less than $20 a barrel, and they said there wasn't enough profit there to do exploration. Now over 100, and we continue with the same support. Is this the government acting for invoking a social good, or is this just power politics?
Go ahead.
I don't know particulars about the tax benefits, how much they were or were not. What I can say is that across the board, anytime the government starts to pick favorites in favor of this industry versus that industry, we tend to get into problems. We get into problems because the government fundamentally is not good at entrepreneurship, and that's what you need, is someone, when you're talking about investing and building industries, you need people who are willing to take risks and take the responsibility of those risks personally, rather than politicians who will push the responsibility off onto taxpayers.
Do you think, Anthony, that the government was wrong to help, I guess, save Wall Street and save the motor companies in Detroit?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The reason we were even having this conversation about bailing out the automobile industries is because we bailed them out back in the 1980s. President Obama, interestingly, came to Pittsburgh here at the G20 summit because he pointed to Pittsburgh as a town that had turned around from the decline of the steel industry. But the fact of the matter is, we turned around precisely because nobody bailed out steel. Steel went bankrupt, and of course that's very painful. Lots of people lose their jobs, but it also frees up a lot of capital, a lot of labor for other industries that can do better to come in and build. And that's exactly what built Pittsburgh.
John, you want to weigh in on that? Then we'll get back to our callers.
I don't, you know, I sort of agree.
Really?
That certainly I was dead set against the bailouts on Wall Street, although I'm far more concerned about the financial industry in particular. There's been a huge financialization of the U.S. economy over the last 30 years to where, managing wealth has become more important than creating wealth. And so you have, you know, say the first thing in the morning at Walmart, the first thing you do is everyone looks at the stock price. And this has shifted us to a very short-term orientation. It'd be kind of like if a football coach tried to score a touchdown on every play rather than trying to string, sort of plays together. I think it hurts our competitiveness. I don't agree completely that the government cannot be entrepreneur in certain areas where I don't want them competing with the private sector, because I completely agree that profit is evidence that people want this. But there are also things that are socially necessary, and profit is not generated when you have poor people involved, for example. So, we kind of agree.
Well, but just picking up on that to you, John Harvey, but we do treat income differently in this country. People who make a salary, that money is treated differently than those who make money through investments.
You mean like financial investments?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And maybe
that's
this
true.
Gets us back to the fairness question that you don't want to deal
with.
Oh, no.
But actually, I will address this.
Okay.
But not from a fairness standpoint. From the standpoint, I'm not so worried in particular about the difference in the way they, deal with capital gains taxes versus income taxes. But I am worried about the organization of our financial market. We've made it easier and easier and easier to buy and sell stocks. And so the amount of research that's necessary. I mean, how many people before they buy a share of stock sit down and find out about this company? Who's on the board of directors? Who are their competitors? What's the history been and so forth? Because you can sell it tomorrow. Now you say, well, but the people who do the research will be the winners. No, that's not true, because the people who are dominating the market are these, not always. You know, the market can go, you know, long periods very rationally. But when it does crazy things, we shouldn't be surprised, because there really isn't, you know, we need to have less emphasis on the financial side of the economy and more emphasis on the real side. And, you know, after all, the stock market really generates no direct income whatsoever for these firms except on, you know, initial sales. So in talking about the way it's dealt with differently, yeah, you're right. I don't know what I would have to say about that, but I would like to see fewer people involved in the stock market, less volume.
Interesting. Well, let me get Tim from Hillsborough to join our conversation. And, Tim, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I would agree that there needs to be a balance between the federal government and private sector. There's never going to be a situation where there's one without the other. However, I would think that the government has a bad rap because of duplicity of services in many, many levels, federally and state-wise. For example, the state of Hawaii has one school district for the entire state. The state of New Jersey has 519. I think that's an area where they could have some kind of savings and keep people on a happy keel.
Fair enough. Tim, thanks for the call. Anthony, redundancy, is that a way to save money?
Well, sometimes it is, and it saves money by allowing what works in the private sector, which is competition. If I'm facing a bunch of school districts, provided I have the choice of which one I want to attend, I force those school districts to compete with each other to provide better products. And this is part of the problem I have with a strong federal government. Effectively, what we've done is set up a political monopoly when we're supposed to be 50 competing political units, and the states that do things right will gain people, they'll gain economy, and the ones that don't will lose. We've lost that competitive aspect to the political process.
Let me get Sarah from Allentown to join us on Radio Time. Sarah, go ahead. You're on the air.
I just take issue with the idea that if we give or let millionaires and entrepreneurs, you know, keep their money without getting taxed, that they're going to create jobs. I just think about Apple, which is sitting on mountains of cash, and yet they're still farming jobs off to the cheap places like China. When are they going to take some of that money and bring jobs to the U.S. and bring some manufacturing jobs here?
It's a fair question. Sarah, if you don't mind, Anthony, let me go back to you, and John, I'd like you to weigh in as well. Anthony, go ahead.
Well, Steve Jobs, before he died, actually had this conversation with President Obama and said, look, if you took away the restrictions on H-1B visas, I could create 30,000 jobs right now. So rather than looking at things that the private sector is not doing and saying the private sector is wrong because of this, the first stop in my book is to ask, what is the government currently doing to prevent the private sector from doing what it needs to do?
But are you saying bring all those Foxconn workers to the United States of America?
Well, I'm saying that if we allowed free entry and exit to the country, what we get is an influx of very talented, very smart people who could then be paid here, living here, raising families here. They would become Americans rather than shipping our hard-earned currency abroad.
But these are people that make a couple hundred dollars a month. I mean, there's just no way that a U.S. worker can compete with those workers.
Sure, and we shouldn't be competing with those workers. We don't do that type of labor well. What Americans do really well is brain labor. We think up neat things. We come up with new ideas. We find new ways to do things. And to the extent that we can export jobs that require less education, we can then create more jobs that require higher education here. It's the basis of trade. We all specialize in what we do well.
Well, John, let me just throw a couple things at you. I mean, it seems to me that it's great to have millionaires and billionaires, assuming they pay their fair share. But it seems to me that a country like the United States needs and wants or must have a strong middle class.
Yeah, and
I mean, shouldn't that be our goal?
And I think Dr. Davies teaches international economics as well. He's thinking about, you know, the theory of comparative advantage. And one of the things we sort of go over very quickly in class when we go over that theory is that we are assuming full employment of resources. So, indeed, if we are going to assume that we're going to have full employment over here, you know, say unemployment around 4% in the U.S., then it doesn't hurt us at all to have these jobs in China where they don't have to follow, you know, health and safety regulations, which is, you know, a big reason why it's so much cheaper. Of course, if we set up a state in the U.S. where we said, yeah, dump the waste in the river, be sure to put a net around the factory in case somebody jumps out and so forth, then, yeah, we could compete as well. And, you know, in terms of having these people come over here, again, you know, how does that address our unemployment problem?
Right. Well, I mean, I think the question is do we have, as Anthony says, enough people thinking up ideas that we can have this full employment that you're talking about, John?
But that's not the problem. The problem is demand. We can saturate, just as you said with the example, and I was talking about government spending. Well, you know, what happens when we get done with our project? The same thing is true in the private sector. And so, you know, basically an expansion is a period of high levels of investment. I mean physical investment, not financial. And then firms start to saturate the market. They okay, we've got enough restaurants built. We've got enough, and it's not overinvestment, as they argue in the Austrian school. It is investment that would be profitable if employment stayed at this level. But then as you start laying off construction workers and so forth, so we come back down the other way. So there's this built-in cycle.
Well, and demand, I mean, doesn't that get you back to needing a strong middle class? So you have people who make a good salary. They don't have to go into debt in order to keep that demand going.
That certainly helps, absolutely.
Anthony, we're almost out of time here. You want to weigh in on that?
Well, yeah, I'd like to underline the point of agreement here, which is, John is arguing that in times of recession, the government can jumpstart the economy by spending more money. I'm somewhat skeptical of that, but I will agree with where I think he will go next, which is after the economy picks up, the government then needs to cut back and go back to the minimalist role it was at before. And that's the key that we're missing currently. What we're seeing is increased government spending in response to recession, in response to bad news, and then like a ratchet, that level of spending remains up and never comes back down again.
Well, we could go on, but we have to end our discussion. Thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
And Anthony Davies, Associate Professor of Economics at Duquesne University. He's also a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center, and that's at George Mason University. John T. Harvey, Professor of Economics at Texas Christian University. And you can read his blog at Forbes.com, and it's called Pragmatic Economics. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.